I'm here with Kit Brady, and it's just outside Saggart on Mill Road, number two, the old cottage. And you were born in 1927.
That's right, yes.
Here all your
Here,
life.
I was born here in this house.
Were you?
I was born
Yes.
here, yeah.
And what, your father lived in this house
Oh,
then, and you, what about your grandfather? Was he?
Well, I never knew my grandfather, you know. They were all dead before I came on the scene. Like, my grandfather on my mother's side, they lived at the Mill Bridge down here, in a little cottage that used to be there. It's all different now.
What name?
Brady, no, my grandfather that was on my mother's side was O'Neill.
O'Neill,
Yeah,
yeah.
O'Neill, yeah. And they lived down at the Mill Bridge. And my grandfather on my father's side, they lived on the green in Rathcoole. My father was born in England and he came home when he was 6. His father was a soldier, like in the British Army. And the wives used to go with them that time, you know. They lived in Portsea, a place called Portsea. I believe it's near Portsmouth
Yeah.
in England. And I think he was 6 or something when they came back home here. And
Well, so the, he's first. Did he talk about his
he
father's time in the
no, that's
army?
the thing that, like, and of course, I never even thought that someday I'd like to know a
Yeah.
bit of the history, you know, because my grandparents are buried down in the graveyard there, and like I don't even know where their grave is. I have an idea where it is, you know, and I know the number of it now, but there's no marker on it, you know. But they all worked in the mill in the old days, not under Swiftbrook now, when it belonged to the MacDonald family, you know. They would have been four of my mother and all worked in it.
So these cottages here would have been maybe the workmen's cottages, would
Oh
they,
yeah,
for
that's
the
the were
mill?
labourers' cottages. That's what they were called then. And like my father, when he was married and all, they lived in Saggart in the village in a little house beside the pub there. It's gone now. It's all gone. You know, it was a thatched house, and they moved from there down to here to this was a new house, 1926, and I was born here.
A
And
year
my
later,
sister was
yeah.
born here, you know. They're all dead. And there's only a sister of mine and myself left out of 11, you know. They all died. My sister is 92. She lives down in Clondalkin, you know, in one of those little houses.
Well, I mean, your memories, your early days growing up here, you went to school.
Oh, yeah, I went to school. Well, the school is harmless, as far as I was concerned, you know. School, like, when I was going to school, there was no worrying about education or anything like that. You know, there was no like third level, like for ordinary people. You had to be able to go to college or that and paid, you know, that sort of thing. But like I went to school and I'd spend a good bit of my time out gathering sticks for the fire in the winter time, along with the rest of it, you know. I never learned a whole lot going to school, you know. All you were facing when you got out at 14, like you were going on to a farm to work, or you know, if you could get work.
And was it the Christian Brothers?
Oh no, the school up here in the village, Mr. Monks, he taught all my brothers and all now. He was fairly old when I came along to be taught. In fact, he'd had a terrible bad accident down, he lived in Crumlin, you know, and he a big lorry ran over his car and he in it, you know.
Oh my
He was he
goodness.
nearly was killed. But
Oh, was it a mixed school?
oh yeah, boys and girls, yeah. It's only a national school, you know. The old school I started in is they're flats now, you know, it's made into apartments because they couldn't knock it down. It was a listed building, you know.
Yeah.
I started there, and then when I was in first class, we moved into the new school. So that's a good while ago now, you know.
I suppose your father, you remember him coming home from the mill
Oh
and all the
yeah,
time.
all my
Did he go
time.
in there as a young lad?
No, you see. When he was married first, like you'd hear stories about before when he left school, he went to school at the Green of Rathcoole. It's a scout den now. If you're in Rathcoole, it's up near the what do you call it, pub,
The pub in the
the
centre of the
up at the
village
top,
there,
no, up at
yeah.
the very top,
Oh, yes.
and like the green, his car park. Some of the cars are parked on where the green used to be. Green is gone, you know. There was a pump and all that in a little house in the middle of it. That's where he was reared. But when he left school, his uncles, the McDermotts, some of them worked on the county council, you know, and he got a job. You know, I remember them doing it. You would never have seen it being done. But when I was a kid, the tarring of the road, the stones were put in heaps, like in certain areas, big heaps. And men sat on them all day with goggles on, little hammers, breaking them into chippings, the stones, you know. They wouldn't be big stones, you know. And he got a job doing that. And he had to go up onto the top of the hill over Rathcoole there. And are you interested in the story like that he told us about him going up there?
Oh, I am.
He was only
left
school now, you know?
Yeah.
And he said he was up there, of course, at daylight. He was a devil for getting up even here. Like, he'd be out there waiting for daylight in the morning to work in the garden, you know? And he said he was breaking away, and he thought he heard something behind him. When he looked around, the mist was down on the hill, you know, and he said this figure was coming out of the mist. He said, I was getting ready to run. Life was frightened out of him, you know, when he saw the figure coming. It was a woman, and she had one of those big tall hats that you see in pictures nowadays. And she says, Lanny, she says, what are you doing up here this hour of the morning? He says, I'm working here breaking these. And who are you? And he said, I was standing, getting ready. I wasn't going to let her get near me, do you know? And he says, my name's Peter Brady. I'm from the Green. Right? Oh, she says, I know your father was Peter as well, you know. She says, come up in 20 minutes and I'll have a cup of tea for you. And he went up anyhow. And he said, when he looked in, like, there was a big kitchen, you know, and the fire was roaring in the grate, you know. And she said, come in there, son, come in. And he said, I was backing in around the door, half afraid still, you know, because he was only left school. And he felt something hitting him on the back of the leg. When he looked around, it was a big eel hanging on the hanger at the back of the door. He said he jumped out in the middle of the floor. She says, what's wrong with you? He says, look at that, look. He said he couldn't talk with the fright he got when he saw it. She says, that wouldn't touch you. My husband brought that wrapped around his body under his shirt when they were cleaning out a lake, maybe up around Johnstown's estate or something, because they wouldn't be allowed to take them, you know.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
They were good food. And,
oh, they were. Yeah, yeah. People used
yeah.
to.
Oh, yeah. To yeah. Things. But anyhow, that was. But he worked in Crookes Lane on the farm. He worked at lots of different jobs, you know.
But on the road as a ganger, did he have a ring that they used to put the stones?
No, I think they used to hold them in their hands and just break them like that, you know.
Yeah.
The hand, I'd blow on their hand, you know.
But would the tiny stones be measured or?
Oh yeah, there'd be chippings, because then when the tarring be getting done, you know, the horse-drawn tarring thing, we'd be all kids out there. The stones would be all put down along the side of the road in heaps, both sides of the road, and the tar would go along, and when they do the strip, the men would shovel the chippings over the. Actually, the roads used to be terrible, you know, for months and months till they get flattened out, you know. It's not like the tar macadam. If you fell on them, you'd be destroyed, you know. But anyhow.
Yeah. But he was doing other little jobs for farmers then.
No, he worked on plenty of jobs. But in my time, he always worked in the mill. You know, I never remember him going anywhere else to work now. But I know he worked up in Crookesling on the farm. There was a big farm attached to the sanatorium, you know. Same as over in Newcastle, at Piemont. But he worked most of his life then up there. For the rest of his life, he worked in it, you know. He was a ganger out in the, over the outside. Well, he used to work inside on guillotines and that, and then he was outside as a ganger over the day workers on the outside in the sheds, you know, so bringing in the wood pulp and the stuff for the men inside making the paper.
Yeah.
He was at that. And then I got a job in the mill. Like, I was under him when I went there first, you know. Then he had a brother. His youngest brother went out to the First World War. He was only a fortnight out there when he was killed. We got him looked up here on the other way. You can check up on the computer. A niece of mine over in Newcastle, she looked him up, and they got all the details.
It wasn't that great.
His age. He was 23 years of age. He was killed on the 17th of August, 1917. His next of kin was Mary Brady, the Green Rathcoole, County Dublin, because she was a widow. Like, his father was, I think, 11 years dead or something before that happened. But we got all that, all where, you know, the section and all that the body would be in, you know.
So there was a great tradition of the Bradys fighting abroad.
He went all right. And I had another uncle in the First World War. We have two of his medals down there. I suppose how we have them, he probably gave them to his sister when he came home. Well, one of his sisters was my mother, you know, O'Neill, Jack O'Neill. And he was in the First World War as well.
And your grandfather, you were telling me,
was he was in the army, but he must have been in the Boer War.
Yes,
you know, he was. That was long before the First World War when because I don't know, he was six or something when he came home, but I don't know what year he would have come home here. You know, the man next door that lived in the house next door was Harry McDermott. He's my father's uncle. Mm-hmm. See, and my father's called Peeny Brady, and. Seemingly, the two of them were nearly the same age, and the lad here couldn't say Pete, or he got the word name Peeny.
Yeah.
Because his uncle couldn't pronounce Pete, you know, because they were kids.
Yeah, and your own name, you're Francis. But
I'm Francis Christopher, yeah.
Yeah, and you got the nickname
Kitty. Well, you see.
How did that come about?
Well, what I think now, like I said, we never had, you know, that kind of interest we inquired. But the only thing that I can think of that might have caused my name to be Kit, because I used to think my name was Kit when I was a child, you know. You'd never hear your right name. And my sister Kitty, the eldest one of our family, she died at 18 with TB, and she died in January 1927, and I was born in December 1927, the end of the year. So I just think that maybe the rest of the family, they were all younger than Kitty, you know. So they probably called me Kit as a sort of a short for Kitty in memory of her or something, you know. Now that's the only, nobody ever told me that now. I'm only thinking that that's why I was called Kit, you know. Like there's plenty of Kits around, you know, and Ratcool and all fellas. And Kit Watkins above was a girl, she was called Kit as well. But I was married as Christopher. I knew, and sure I was years married and all when I discovered my first name was Francis. She wants to hear your woman as she thinks of it when it's mentioned, you know, Betty.
Okay, yeah. You know, I think it's interesting though, yeah. How simple life was in those days.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah. It was for like Saggart School turned out. Now, I remember when I got to school, Mr. Monks, he was a very nice, good teacher and that, but he was getting old when I came along. He didn't show much interest in the lad that was a bit slower at, you know. But like he used to bring out stuff to a group of girls and boys in the sixth class, you know, that more stuff over and above what he should be teaching them, you know. Now, there was one family up on the hill there, and Megan was their name. They're nearly all dead now as well. They would have been all older than me, you know. I went to school with the younger ones. And they're all dead. There's only one of the girls left now that I went to school with. Out of the two, those two families of Megans up there. And one of a couple of those men had good jobs. Billy now was in the civil service, and Mike was in it as well. Billy was when I was idle, I didn't know anything about what he did until a neighbour told me, and. She said you should get in touch with Billy Megan. Mm-hmm. I said, what can he do? She says he's in charge of anybody working as civilians in Baldonnell. But you'd have to go through the labour leg. So I rang him, and he wrote to me and all, and told me to tell them in the labour what I'd like to work at if there was anything going, you know, that I'd like to work in Baldonnell. So they take in, every year they take in so many electricians and fitters.
Yeah.
Right. But they have to bring helpers as well. So I was there as a helper, you know, and I did two terms. I did 12 months altogether in Baldonnell in two separate terms. And it was smashing because it was easy work and that, you know. But that was in the before I retired, you know, just.
I know,
jumping ahead now, you know.
But it because your father worked in Swiftbrook,
yeah.
Paper mills.
Yeah.
It would make sense that you would follow in your father's footsteps.
Oh, yeah, but all my family worked. And there was 10 of us, like, and my mother and father, and they all worked there. from time to time. Like, my brother, just older than me, he worked in it when he was young during the war. And he left and went and joined the army. He spent his life in the army.
But, and the management there, who was your boss?
Oh, well, the owner was Hosborough. Rye was his name, Rye Hosborough. And he wasn't the kind of a man, like, he wouldn't say hello to you or anything, you know, if he met you. But, he sacked you. Men got sacked for drinking a cup of tea and, of course, smoking. You were gone if you were caught smoking. But the thing was, even out in the toilets, to go out the toilets to smoke, you know, he'd walk out there and catch you, you were gone. That was it. There's no allowance that you weren't doing any harm out there, you know. But you'd get back after a few months if you kept looking for your job, you know, he'd take you back. But you were sacked, you know.
So a strict man.
Oh, very strict, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think he said to somebody he couldn't afford to be nice to workers. You know, and he could have had a lot of truth there too, you know. You could be too nice and you wouldn't be getting things done that should be done, you know, work.
How many employees there?
There was around, I think there was between 300 and 400 at one time in it, you know. That was in my time now. Before that, I wouldn't say there was that many because there was two machines.
Yeah.
Do you know? And then when I started there, they brought up two more machines. You know, there was four machines there, paper making machines. And so I'd say there was around the 400 in it.
Yeah.
Do you know?
You would have seen the good times and the bad times there.
Oh, yeah. Well, when I went into it in 1947, I went into it from the fire. I worked in the forestry. And I went in there, and it was grand, like working on the outside gang. You know, there's no worries there. That was bringing in wood pulp and bringing in clay and all the stuff that went into the paper making. The outside gang supplied it from the sheds. You know?
Was your father still there at that stage?
Oh, yeah, my father was there for years, you know, after I went into it. And you brought in the stuff, and then you had to leave in a supply of stuff for that they'd want for the night shifts, you know, until the next morning and that. It was easy, but I tell you, I was put on a night shift, and my brother was a boiler man, right? And they were burning oil at this time, and it wasn't the nice diesel that you get now, you know. It was real thick, black, tarry sort of stuff, and it came from a third story, you know. You had to pump it up to the tank, and there's no way of knowing when you'd be full, you know. So it was a very handy little pump. It only was a little handle, and you stood like this, you know. That's how easy it was. And I was in the oil house. It was on a night shift, and I was pumping, and I was singing all the songs I knew. And then I said, God, I said, I better go up and see. Is the tank nearly full? And when you went up to the first landing, you turned in, and there was no light, you see, and you just turned in to go up the next floor. And when I went into the dark part of the room, I could hear the rain falling, you know. I said to myself, it's raining since I came in the door, you know. That was the roof that the rain was hitting. And when I went up the next, there was a light up on the top floor. Here's the aisle coming across the floor, just getting ready to come down the stairs.
My God.
And it's terrible. Oh, it was dreadful stuff, you know. And of course, the night shift foreman got all the lads he could spare, you know, and we get all old empty sacks out of the shed, china clay sacks and that, and threw it on it. Then it was a sort of a loading shed. You could open doors up there and throw the sacks out, and they were brought down and burnt in the coal burners, you know.
Yeah.
Because they weren't working. But I heard no more, and the electrician shop was on the ground floor.
Yeah.
And they were all day clean. So I went into that night, and I was talking to some of the lads, and I said, God, I'll be in trouble, you know. And, ah, don't worry, Kit. Paddy Flynn, when he was pumping the aisle there, he said, met it coming out the door on the ground floor. You know, whether that was true or not, but I would believe it would.
Yeah.
It was so easy, you know. You weren't going up and looking to see, so as to stop pumping, you know. You could pump all
night.
Were
you blamed for that then?
No, never heard a word.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not a word.
Would the lads cover up for you?
No, no, you couldn't cover it up, you know, like the dirt and all down the floors and all had to be done. But it was an accident, so.
Yeah.
And there was plenty of accidents now, and like if you had to pay for maybe the bit of damage you do or the loss of a reel of paper, that, you know. But nothing to be done, it wouldn't be done deliberate, you know, but you could get in, you could get sacked, all right. I know when I went there first, there was three fellas coming back after being out sacked. And one of them was a cutter man. And he was sacked. When he went into his shift, there was two little butts of reels to be cut. And he cut them. But one of them was a plain sheet and the other one was a wire. He was sacked. There was no excuse. And it wasn't two big reels he cut, you know, because if it was, he'd be checking it, so, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was so little on the two bars, like, that he didn't check it.
Yeah, but it wasn't it wonderful how it kept so many people locally here employed?
Yeah.
And how long did, was it going I was fairly in well it, I was all
in,
the time?
Oh, yeah. And I was in it for 24 years, and then it shut. Clondalkin bought it, and then they shut it. They shut my side, I was on number one machine, so they shut my side. Everything on that side, cutters, the beaten loft and all, you know, all went. But then it went for about 2 years, I think, after that.
Yeah.
And what they were doing, they were only experimenting all the time. They were bringing in big tanks of acid and different chemicals, trying to make paper cheap or something, or whatever they were doing, you know, but it didn't work anyhow. But when they bought it, we thought, like, there was loads of room up there. Maybe Clondalkin will build a new building and put in a new machine and all that, because my brother-in-law was in Minnesota visiting his daughter 1 year. And he came back. I says, lads, you may forget about paper making. He said, I was brought through a mill over there, he said. And there was a Japanese machine in, he said, and it was 2 year going. It never stopped for 2 years. And he said, we made a reel of paper, maybe 6 foot wide or 5 foot and 4 foot, you know. And there might be maybe, if you had a good big reel and wide, it'd be 1,000 pound weight, you know. But he said they were making reels over there. He said they were 15 foot wide, he said, and I couldn't look over it. He'd be tall. That's the way he described it, you know. But I could, because the machines up there were ancient, you know. They were real old machines. Yeah.
Well, you see, you were coming from that time
to the new type
of machinery.
Yeah, yeah.
But can you describe the factory, the ground floor and...
The only way I could really describe that to you now is to get the photographs.
Yeah.
And I could start at the first page and show you the machines as they went down, because I took them all.
Yeah.
Like when I worked in it, I used to take them at night when there would be nobody around and that. And when I worked in the glazed room at the time, so I was able to ramble around with the cutter or that, if you're working on it, you know. So if you like, I'll get the album and I'll...
Oh, do. Get the photographs and we'll go through them.
Do.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing these.
Yeah, right. When I got these, it was Kieran and Mrs. McNally.
Yeah.
When they got a lend of these, I gave them permission.
Kieran below in the library.
Yeah, in the library.
Yeah.
And I'd given the lend of these to Shea Watkins, Jim Watkins, and he was going to do a book on the mill, write a book about the mill. And they got a lend of them off him, and they printed them all, gave me all these copies.
Oh, sure, that was brilliant.
Right, so, well, that was brilliant. I was, but there was no sign of him giving me these back, do you see? But I rang him. He went moved to Killaloo, so he did. He sent them back to me right away, you know.
Now, this is the village.
Yeah, the top of the tower. Church there.
This is Saggart.
Yeah, Saggart.
And describe it to me the way you remember it now in the early days.
Well, in the early days now, there was a row. See, that's the end of the pub, right? Jacob's pub is over
this
that
main
side.
Street
now. Yeah, this is the main street. There's the mill chimney there. And that's that building there that you can see the gable end of it. That was the pavilion. It was a dance hall, a club in the mill, you know, and they built this when I remember them building it when I was
and
a kid.
And they built that dance hall just for the workers?
Oh, yeah, it was a club, yeah. And it was a beautiful, smashing place, you know.
Yeah.
And they used to hold big dances there when I was a kid, you know. But when I went in to work there, they still had a good few big dances in it. You know, bands that come there. Butler and that guy that played the organ from down the country, Delahunty, and a good few of those. But they used to come there. And It was supposed to be only for members, but like once there was no trouble, anybody could.
That's not where you met your wife, is it?
No, I met my wife at a wedding in Ratcoole. A cousin of mine was married, and it wasn't a wedding, it was a party after the wedding. And she lived next door.
What's your wife's name?
Betty, Elizabeth, but she's from Kilkenny. She was up living with an aunt who had lost her child. She came here when she was only four, left school. She came up here and asked the mother could to keep her for a while, you know, to replace the little one, the last. And she met me, and that was the end of it. So,
now the
that's the village, and
the mill itself is
the mill. There is all along out. There. You can't see it there now, do you know? But this is the inside now. This is the starting of the mill. They were called breakers. That's where the rag, when they used a lot of rag. Now, in my time, they used very little rag, but because the wood pulp and all had come in. And these were breakers. Now, my sister told me about these. There used to be maybe two girls be standing there. See, the stuff would be going around, goes under this hood. There's a roll lad there. There they are there at the back. They're spare ones, you know, with blades.
And all these machines now had to be manned.
Oh, yeah, there'd be a man running each of them. And there's the bales of wood pulp. See them?
I do
there was about 400 weight in those.
The knives very, must have been terrible.
Oh, yeah. But those now, the rag was there, and she said you'd be standing there picking out little bits of coloured bits that wouldn't break up, you know. That was there. The only tiny little specks, maybe. And that said this, there was a lot of bleach used. She said you'd be as sick as a dog from the smell of the bleach, you know.
Yeah.
And
the knives and the smell,
yeah. And that was for the rag. This was this was called a beater. It did the same thing, but it was wood pulp, and the rag would go in there when it'd be finished here.
Mm.
It'd be mixed with wood pulp and
all this work must have been very monotonous too. You know, can you imagine just standing there and picking bits off?
Yeah, for the women.
And was there any talking going on? Like,
it wouldn't be that noisy that you couldn't talk. Now, even in the machine room.
Yeah,
wouldn't be that noisy. You could talk easier than I'm talking to you. I'm talking very loud. See, that's the machine. That's the wet end of the machine there. Yeah, there's several of them now. That's the machine I worked on, but I wasn't working on it when I took those photographs, you know. There's the same again, they say. And that's the dandy there behind him across the sheet.
No, the workmen, including yourself in there at the time, there was no formal dress, was there?
Oh, no, you just had a pair of rubber boots, that's all. You used to get short rubber boots with laces in them. You know, you wouldn't be wearing the big long ones that kill you to heat, you know. And, well, you could use shoes on you, but, like, you'd get wet feet, do you know. That would be the thing, because there'd be a lot of water flying around.
With your sleeves folded up.
Oh, yeah, or rolled up this far, yeah. And you could go along with nothing on you at times.
And
you know?
The braces.
Yeah, definitely. You'll see photographs of that. They see that chap there now?
Yeah.
That's Jim Mullally. He worked, me and him ran that machine. Only two men on that machine now. And he was my back tender, my helper. I was the machine man, he was the helper. And two men ran that. The other machine was beside you there, and there was two men. No, there was three men on that, because there was a sizer in the middle. You'll see it now as we go along. It took three men. One man was on the sizer. That was his job, to keep a vat of size, and the paper was put through it, you know. And that was his job, to keep it the right temperature and the right weight and all that in it. But that was Jim. Jim, you'd be sent up now for vitriol to do a clean a dandy or that, you know. And vitriol was a very severe acid, you know. You couldn't let it get near you. And he slipped coming down the stone stairs the winter's night. And you used to go up there, and you'd have to go out in the yard, because it'd be out in the yard, and there wouldn't be a light or anything. You'd be going along, you know, these jars in the basket, you know. And you'd be going along shaking the jar, see which one had stuff in it. You know, there'd be a lot of empty ones there. And he slipped coming down with the rubber bucket and it half full of vitriol. And all he could think of was to keep his eyes shut. That wouldn't get into his eyes, you know. And the lads whipped his claws off, tore the claws off him as quick as they could. And the only place, he got a little bit of a burn here and a little bit of a burn to heal, where it took him too long to get the boot off, you know. And then they had him up again a wall with two hoses on him to wash him off. You know, inch hoses with pressure pump, you know, pressure hoses. and they washed them
off. So would accidents like that occur on a regular basis?
Well, I'll tell you about more accidents as we go along. His clothes were destroyed, and he asked the mill manager, who was Mr. Yoon, he said, could we get anything to replace my clothes? He said, a few pounds. Because at that time, a trouser and a shirt and a pair of rubber boots, £4 or £5 to buy them for you, you know. And a couple of weeks went by, and one day he said to Mr. Yoon, Mr. Yoon, did you ask the boss about that? Oh, he says, Jim, I was waiting to get him in good humour. I'm going to start talking about it. He says, well, do you mind if I ask him the next time he comes up here? Not at all, Jim. They were afraid their lives of the boss, you know. And first day he came up, he stopped them and asked them, and he had his check that night going home.
Did he? Oh, yeah. The mill manager,
Mr. Yoon. Yoon was his name.
Where did he come from?
He was a Dublin man.
Well, was he brought in specially?
No, he worked there when I was a child. Because when we'd be standing going to school, he used to come from town on a motorbike. And then when he became manager and he was married and all, his house is up here just behind us.
Was that house especially?
It belonged to the mill. And it's after being sold now, and there's the apartments built on this site, you know, up there, just up around from the crossroad, you know.
Yeah.
That's just a machine now, different. They're cylinders, dryers, you know.
Was it an equal amount of women as men working?
Oh, there was a lot of women, but not up the, no women up the machine room, only men, you know. And
what were the women doing?
The women were in the finishing house, counting and sorting the paper. You won't see any of the women, but there's a picture of the finishing house. That's like after he's testing the paper, Desi Riley. He only died months back. All those lads are dead.
Where did the paper go eventually?
It was also, they used to sell a lot of it down to Cork, to a printers in Cork. The lorries used to go down there a lot, and a lot of it would be in the town, in the city it all went. Because it wasn't a place that could make an awful lot of paper, you know. Do you know what I mean? They'd always be nearly behind for orders and that. See, that's a calendar, a super calendar, we call it. That was for putting the glaze on the paper. I worked on that before. Like, you'd be going from a cutter to a calendar and then up the machine, you know.
How many years did you spend there?
I was 24 years in it. Yeah. When it shut, you know, when my side of it shut.
And this was when it was with all the old type
of machinery. There was nothing else in it. See, that's me there now. That's me when I was a cutter man, working on a cutter. Like taking my own photograph there, you know.
Well, I must say, you did take fantastic photographs. And was there, days that you had to meet a particular order?
Oh, yeah. And
was there panic at any stage?
Oh, it was good panic. I mean, there was. And they see that you could be in the machine room there, and you could be thrown out wet broke where Jim Mullally was there with the hand car behind him. There you are. That's the paper in this sort of wet form, you know, before it gets down through the cylinders. And you could be throwing that out for hours. You wouldn't be able to get it going, you know. You could be all day trying to get some orders, you know. There were some orders now, and you started the order and it was great, steady going, you know. But most of the trouble in the mill in the latter years was trying to speed up to make more, you know, because they weren't able to cope. They weren't able to keep up, you know. Not with the orders, but to make the paper quicker, faster. Now, I'd go in on my shift, and the foreman, the first thing he'd come out, bring her up a couple of feet, speed up a couple of feet only, you know. And that meant adding on stuff, and the minute you bring her up, maybe it'd start, the paper start breaking and giving you awful trouble, you know. They'd have fellas up in the glaze room carrying the waste paper back up to the shed. You'd be making that much of it, you know. But it was, and then when the wire had had to be changed, it was a very hard going, you know.
Where did all the waste go to?
They reused it. To put it back into the
recycled.
Oh, yeah, it went back in again. It'd be mixed in with so much waste, their shavings off the cutter now. Do you know, the cutter cutting the paper. And that was all just waste that would go back up, and be a lot of it up in the shed. It wouldn't be used right away, like, you know. There'd be only a certain amount of it put back in each time, you know.
Yeah. Now you saw the operation, and you worked literally from the very cutting the trees down in the forest, dragging them into the mill.
Yeah.
And going through the whole process, what happened when the tree was reached the mill?
No, but you see, we didn't do wood pulp. The wood pulp was bought in from Canada.
It ever bought in locally here?
Oh, yeah, down in Clondalkin it was.
Yeah.
Oh, but that was an awful job. But I never, no, we never did that. They started making wood pulp down in Clondalkin. Mm-hmm. Do you know? But that machine had to be put on a four-shift system because they couldn't stop up for a weekend because it took too long to get it going on the Monday. They could be all day trying to get it going, right? And we were brought through when Clondalkin bought us up here, and we were brought down in our turns to brought through Clondalkin Mill to be showing it and all. And I'm telling you, that was one job you wouldn't want to be working at the wood pulp plant.
Why is that now?
I tell you, the wood came in, you know, the little trees you see in the forestry, do you know? And they came in big trolleys, and they were hydraulic, and they were put in beside the man. There was a man up here on a height, right? Because the grinder was a huge big stone, you know, that did the timber.
Yeah.
And there was two ovens, like big oven doors. And your man had opened this one, and as fast as he could throw it, this timber would be all this length, you know, as fast as he could throw it in, fill it. And while he'd be doing that, it'd be stuff, wet pulp would be coming out in a minute. And he slammed that door, and then it was time to open. That's the way they were going. They only did, I think, 2 hours at a time, and then they were putting something else. There'd be another lad put up, you know. They kept them going circle, you know. Because there was such a... I believe the men that worked on that job, all they were interested in was the work, the horses and the pub. That's all they did.
Can you imagine the heat coming out of those?
Yeah, there'd be no heat there now. It was the stone was grinding the timber when it'd be thrown in, you know.
When those logs were thrown in, all the little splatters splinters coming back out.
Yeah, it wouldn't be splinters, it'd be pulp. Do you know, the timber would be getting fired out with this stone flying around, you know.
But not a very pleasant job.
No, it wasn't a nice job. No, it wasn't. And that's the sizer now. That's it there. The paper went in there through the size, you know. He was the sizer, man. There was three men, and that was number two machine.
Oh, well, there's so much very interesting material. I'm just seeing you all sitting down here having a cup of tea.
Yeah, you had your tea at your work.
Did you?
There was no canteen or anything for that. There was, but not for us, not for the machine worker. That was the glaze room. You could sit down there because you could stop your machine, the calendars and the cutters, and sit down and have your tea.
Yeah.
But like there was eight of us in the glaze room. But up the machine, the fellow went up, made a tea, and you hoped that the machine wouldn't break down or anything while you were having your tea because you had to follow the machine.
Yeah.
Do you know?
And the women again, you must talk to me about them. Yeah. They worked in the finishing room.
Yeah, in the finishing house. Yeah. The paper was brought in from the cutters, right? And they were wheeled in. And the women sorted it. Now, I don't know what order it would be done in. There were sorter women and there was counters. Now, the counters used to count the paper. And they could count the paper and sort of talk to you at the same time when they got real good at it, you know. Because they did it with their fingers. They used to get the paper like this. You see the board of paper. She'd be standing there beside that, and she'd get the paper and get it out like this, you know. But they'd fan it out, and they go along with the finger, so many sheets on each finger, and that's the way they counted it. And the good ones could talk to you. You could stand and talk to her, and she'd be counting away with the finger, and they knew like so many times, and they'd have a ream done. Like some reams were 500 sheets, some reams were 480 sheets.
All those have to be counted.
Definitely. And had to be sorted before it was counted.
Yes.
You see, because when you were up in the machine and you had to keep an eye on the weight of the paper that you were making. So the way you watched it, when you change a reel, of course you'd weigh it. But then when, if the weight was wrong, you put on stuff or knocked off stuff, then you had to tear out a piece out of the side of the reel. Well, they had to watch out for those. But you put a marker in where you tore out a piece, you know, so as it'd be known. But that's all those women, and you see them carrying that sometimes. They come out to the cutter for some, and you see them big sheets. They just get a big bundle of them and fold them like that and let them on their hip and away they go. You wouldn't carry it yourself, you know. They were great women. They worked hard, you know. You know, and then the packers were in there as well. The packers were in the place down here. You see the, I didn't photograph the packing, but I did the scales and that where they worked and the guillotines now are in that as well. There's the guillotine now there.
Yeah.
And there's the paper packed and all. Then there'll be girls will be labelling that, sticking on the labels for the different paper, you know, on the reams.
Was there any ever an accident?
Oh, there was. Now, they were all guillotines. Mm. They got a new one in, and it was all automatic. Do you know, they had two buttons, had to press two buttons to work
with
on
with the old ones.
My brother lost all his fingers off one hand just 2 years before the mill show. He was working guillotines all his life, and Mick was his name. And see, you were supposed to press the two buttons, right? So that your hands were away, before the knife would go, you know. And he was, see, there's a fella, or it could be a girl, dressing the reams for you, do you know, getting them even and handing them in to you, and you put them in and onto the, when you had them in, you pressed the buttons. And the chap that was at the hand says, Mick, the ticket is still in it. Do you know, you'd have there'd be a ticket in every ream with people's names on it that sorted it and counted it and all that, you know. And didn't Mick do that with his two hands to brush out the thing? And the clamp came down. See, the clamp comes down first. And it's got his two hands. But he got his right hand out and the knife came down and got the chopped all his fingers off and a little bit of his thumb. And that was only about 2 years before.
My God. Can you imagine, though, you know, just looking at your hand and seeing all the fingers
my
gone?
My father lost the top of his finger. My other brother, Mick himself, lost the top of his two long fingers. He worked in the, when I was only a kid now, that happened. He caught them in the two cog wheels and his two long fingers got caught and he lost the tops off them. Then he lost a whole lot of them then later on in life, you know. But he got over all that and everything, you know.
Was that all part and parcel of the, well, I'll tell of the work?
Well, you know? I tell you, another accident you'd have, and I didn't, the only one I ever had was starting the reel. So the reel that finishes there, if it's a bottom reel, and you're starting this one, and it's running, and if you weren't quick enough, this one would pull you in. I got burned, like, cut there, and the reel turning, you know, the reel's fast, it'd be very fast, and it took all the skin here on my wrist, you know. And all you did, you went into the office and the foreman had the first aid kit and he put a yoke on your arm with a bandage thing, you know, for burns. And off you went out again to your work. There was no... Tim Mansfield got caught in the cylinders. Going... See, you had to lace the paper through the cylinders. Do you know, you had... That's the dandy room, by the way. They're the dandies that put the watermark in the paper. When you had to bring the paper from the very wet end right down through the cylinders. And Tim Mansfield, of course, his hand went up between the felt and the cylinder. The cylinder would be red hot, you know, and burned the bloody arm off him as well. So there was lots of... And my brother Peter out in the boiler when they were doing the coal burner. And occasionally there'd be a build-up of gas in at the back of the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And it would explode. Well, if the door was shut, you were all right. But he was throwing in coal, feeding it. And he heard the explosion and he went to get out of his way and like a sweeping brush tripped him or something that was lying on the floor. And it caught him, it hit him in the face, the flame coming out. Got an awful lot of burn. A couple of them now up there got burnt that way. But not so bad that it left him with loads of scars around, you know. But it left him in a lot of pain, all right, you know.
But very much an occupational hazard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what's
and the what about compensation? Was
No, you didn't look for compensation because if you did, you'd lose your job and you wouldn't get it again. Because in the old days, a man down the road here, that, now these men are all dead and gone. He lost a half a finger And he sued, and I believe he got around £80 at the time, which was a lot of money then, you know. But neither him or any of his kids ever worked in a mill again.
Yeah.
None of them. Not one of them. And they lived, there used to be a row of little houses up at the mill gate, the back entrance there. They're all gone now, where those families lived. And none of them people got, none of his sons ever worked in a mill.
My goodness, yeah. No. All because he claimed for his finger. Yeah.
John Fielding, that fella, he was a back tender on number two machine when I was a back tender on number one. He was my best friend. We were we went everywhere together. And he got a bad cut on his thumb, got slashed on the thumb. And nobody'd have a car then, you know. And Mr. Ewan, the manager, brought him over to Dr. Clark in the dispensary beyond. She says, John, don't let her keep you out now for a week with that. Get your thumb stitched and back to work, you know. Well, that's the way it was. That's me. I'm just posing at that now, you know, during the dinner hour, all the women and all were all gone home.
Yeah. Now, did you have good fun there?
Oh, yeah. When the things would be going well on a night shift. Sure. We used to get our tea. We'd move in. When we were in the glaze room, we'd go into that finishing house and back into a corner where there was a packer's bench. And we were in there and we'd have our tea on the night shift at 1 o'clock in the morning. And Paddy O'Neill was the boiler man. They're all here for me to show them to you. And we used to put a wrapper on the floor and throw the old tea on the tea leaves out of the cups onto the wrapper, and then we'd be able to gather it all up. So Paddy used to come in every night and he'd be coming in to make his tea. You know, you made your own tea from a burko, you know. And he walked in and all he could see was the end of the wrapper sticking up, and he gives it a kick. And there's a lovely big board of paper this height, a loose leaf ledger, real expensive, heavy paper, all ready for packing. And the tea leaves were all up along the side of the tea and jail. So there was eight of us, you see, four cutter men, calendar men, and their helpers. So the helpers went out and they got the cutters and calendars going, and the other lads stayed in, and they all got blades. There'd be lots of old blades around that time. And they got an empty board, pallet, really, you would call it. And they just scraped the sheets with the blades like that, and they took the ream off, and they turned all the reams opposite to one another. They didn't leave the one side all the time, you see. So it cut down on whatever. But there was never a word. The tea couldn't get between the sheets now.
Yeah.
You know, because the paper was that heavy and tight. And they only had to scrape the stain off with the edge of a blade. And they were hours at that, doing that, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And you were saying, you know, when things got good, you have a good old bit of fun as well.
Oh, yeah, you would. And throwing water, bags of water and all. And then number two machine, the dry end, it had a hood over it, hardboard, you know. And the watchman would come in, and Tom Healy, and be a back tender, and he'd go in behind him. Somebody would be keeping sitting on a stool talking, you know. And they had all little holes bored in the hardboard, didn't they? And fill your mouth with water and get them in the back of the neck, you see. So this night, he was just sitting down, and the buddy, he looked at the thing first. There's no hole there, so he sat up a bit from where the holes were. And your man is inside with a penknife, and he tried to bore a hole. And your man could feel the board behind him. He was lying back again, and he could feel it moving, you know. But that's thinking like that. That photograph now and a couple more were entered in a competition here during the year.
Yeah, there's three of you now sitting down here.
That's my brother Peter.
Yeah.
That's Jim Riley. They were the three by.
And that's Paddy O'Neill.
Paddy O'Neill, yeah.
And what were you doing there?
That was during the summer holidays, see? And do you see the back of the boiler is open there? That's the oil burner boiler. And the mason would be in there re-bricking it. And the pipes that the water went through, the ends would be all shown there. And the fitters would be in. Some of them would come loose, you see, and the water would escape.
Yeah.
And they tightened them up with a gadget, you know, for stretching them. And that's what they'd be doing. But these three lads were cleaning the flues. They get extra money to clean the flues. Now, the flues meant they were about 4 foot or 3 foot in diameter. Tunnels from the chimney up. from the fire boiler up to the chimney, and they had to get down on their hands and knees and crawl up there. That's why they're all done up with old rags to keep the soot from getting in around them, you know. And they'd crawl up, they'd bring up an old sack, and they'd scrape the soot onto the sack. They wouldn't put it into it. Now they're scraping onto it and drag it back to a manhole to, and put it out. That's what they were doing there now.
Do you ever remember the horse-drawn cars that would come up to collect the
paper? No.
Before your time?
Yeah, because even when I was a child and we'd be playing on the road out there, the only lorry that would go by would be the mill lorry. And I remember well, it was a lorry with hard rubber wheels on it and spokes, and it had a little brushes about this width hanging on the axle, on the wheel, you know, on the end of the wheel.
Yeah.
So what they were for, whether they were just sort of an ornament for keeping the dust off the wheels or what, I don't know. But that was that's the only lorry now that I... there was no horse in my time.
In your living memory, the mill always had its own lorry.
Yeah, they always had a lorry, yeah, they had. But like my father and a man up the road there... when they weren't working years ago, they used to go up to the hill over Talla somewhere and dig stones out of the side of the hill with crowbars and sell them. Like fellas come up with horse and cart for the road, for the county council.
Yeah.
Now, that was, I don't know how long that would have lasted, but when they were, like that mill up there was shut for years, you know, between owners and that, you know, because a family by the name of MacDonald owned it first. They owned all the mills. Like if you read Kieran's books there, they built mills, Talla, Old Bon, Crumlin, down at, there was the Clondalkin, and Drimina paper mill. There was all mills around, you know. They were gone in my time now, Drimina and Killeen. And this MacDonald family were the principal people. But they all died out. And the only one that was left was a Jesuit, and he had to get rid of it. It had to be sold, you know. So as far as I know, there was a Drury ran the mill before Hosborough, you know. But I don't know anything about him. I meant to ask my sister if she remembered them, you know, the Drurys. But anyhow, Hosborough was our lad, the lad I remember.
And there was a gap, was there?
It was shut for a while, all right, yeah.
And your father was out of work.
I don't know when my father went to work in the mill, you know, but he was in it all my lifetime anyhow, because he was a foreman all my lifetime, I think, because at Christmas, all the foremen got a Christmas box, a turkey. Huge big turkey area they'd all get, and the stuffing and the sausages and everything to go with it, you know. It was so big that Tom Watkins above, his wife used to cook it because they had a big Aga cooker, you know. And they used to cook the turkey for him here.
And that was given out at Christmas?
Yeah, at Christmas time. That was a present, you know. Yeah. But in latter years then, fitters and all, lads in charge up there, foremen and all, they used to get a bonus, you know. But at that time, they didn't get bonus. That was a present at Christmas, you got. But it was only the foreman got it, you know.
You were saying your father, he when he was out of work, he went up to the hill. To the hill.
Yeah, over Talla somewhere. And he used to walk, and they wouldn't have, like I even heard my mother saying that he'd go off in the morning and he wouldn't take bread or anything because he'd leave it for the kids, you know. He had a gang of kids.
And what they'd do is
a crowbar, and be rooting the stones out of the hill.
For
the county council. Men had come up with horse and carts and pay them so much for the stones, you know.
Yeah.
Now, that's another thing that I didn't get him to give, you know, details. But like, his friend that used to go with him worked in the mill, and he told me about it as well, you know. But you didn't just have the interest or the you know, to talk about. And we never heard him talking about his brother that was killed in the war, you know. Never.
Well, Kit Brady, looking back over the milling life, it's fascinating, isn't it? A great story indeed.
Yeah, it is.
And thank you very much for telling it to me. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.